Late Night Live. Ideas and opinions from around the world.
And our whimsical theme welcomes you to another edition of Late Night Live. Now, I've been doing this for over 20 years, and we quite often have shall we say, technical problems backstage. But, boy, we've had a whopper tonight up there with Chernobyl. But we soldier on. In a few minutes, I'll be introducing you to three splendid guests. Anne Pettifer, Executive Director of Advocacy International and a Senior Associate of the New Economics Foundation, to John Quiggin, Federation Fellow in Economics and Political Science at the University of Queensland, and Nick Nuttall, who's the spokesperson to the Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme. And we're going to be discussing not the need for a new deal, because as you probably noticed already, our shiny bright new Prime Minister has just been giving us an echo of FDR's New Deal, but a Green New Deal. Why does that matter at the moment? Well, for yonks, far-sighted commentators, including some that have been on the program, have been warning us of the looming credit collapse. But, of course, no one did a damn thing about it until it had collapsed. And now we're immensely distracted by it. And it combines, of course, it's a part of this perfect storm with dwindling energy supplies and accelerating climate change. And many people are using those problems as an excuse to not deal with climate change. But my guest tonight will be arguing the case for a Green New Deal. Those of you who enjoy the 7:30 Report, our fraternal programme on ABC television, will enjoy Thursday nights in particular, because on that occasion two fellows sit down opposite each other and play the role of interviewer and interviewee, and one of them, the little bald bloke, without any help from makeup or costuming, pretends to be every politician pretty much in Australian history, and a few internationals as well. Well, that mysterious person, John Clark, will be my guest a little later on in the program. And while he's not here, and because he'd be too embarrassed if I was to say it in his earshot, I'm going to say that I think John's on my short list of the half dozen most marvellous Australians. But before we introduce Anne and John and Nick, I want to tell you why I'm under a bit of stress tonight. It's not simply the Chernobyl meltdown I talked about, but the fact that I can't read. I had a rather nasty run-in with my eye, which necessitated a rapid trip to hospital at the weekend, and I'm still wandering around bumping into things. Now, last night, I'm sitting here squinting at scripts and trying to run the program, and I had another problem, apart from being cyclopean, and that was that I realised that I'd locked myself out of the house. And I knew all the way through the program that I'd have to go home and deal with this issue. Now, my little house in Sydney is narrow but incredibly tall and thin. It's four stories, would you believe? And I thought, well, the only chance of getting in is with a ladder to the third level. So I get home, it's dark at night, I'm blind as a bat, and I'm trying to assemble a particularly unpleasant extension ladder. I drag it up to place, I position it dangerously on some steep stairs, and I prop it up against this lofty balcony. And I had a near-death experience getting up the top and managing to climb onto the balcony. And I knew that the second I opened the door, which fortunately was unlocked, all hell would break loose. Sirens blasted. Everyone in Paddington was woken from their slumbers. And I run downstairs, cancel the alarm. And then I get the call from, you know, the command centre, and they want to know what the hell I'm on about and who am I and why have I just broken into Mr. Adams' house. And I found this rather difficult to explain, really. Then they demanded a code word. Well, for heaven's sake, who remembers code words? I haven't used the damn thing for 10 years, and I explained that. He said, I'll give you a hint, it's an explorer. So I went through every explorer I could think of, from Columbus to Magellan to all the hard-working Australians who perished in our deserts, and none of them were right. And then, just as he was going to send the cops, he said, OK, what's your phone number? I don't know my phone number. I never phone me. I'm the last person to ask. Anyone else knows my number, but anyway, it was a bad night. I'm a complete wreck, and I'm still blind as a bat. So if the program goes awry tonight, please don't blame the guests. It ain't their fault. Next month in Washington, President George W. Bush, still President George W. Bush, unfortunately, will gather together leaders of the G20 to discuss what's to be done about the global financial meltdown. And, of course, there's a rumour going around that George Bush didn't know what the G20 was until our shiny bright new Prime Minister put him right. But nonetheless, he'll get to meet almost all of them on the 15th. Now, the question being asked in many circles is whether now is the time to take the opportunity of the financial crisis to restructure the market to tackle that triple crunch I mentioned earlier. Now, earlier this year, the independent UK think tank, the New Economics Foundation, published a report outlining what it has termed a Green New Deal. It calls for various actions, including tougher regulation of the financial market and a sustained program of investment in energy conservation and renewable energy. One of the New Economics Foundation senior associates is the aforementioned Ann Pettifer and was one of the leaders of the Jubilee 2000 campaign to cancel the debts of 42 of the world's poorest countries, and I remember we applauded her efforts at the time. She's also the exec director of Advocacy International and the author of The Coming World, First World Debt Crisis, and she's on the blower from London. In Nairobi, we have Nick Nuttall. Nick is the spokesperson, as I said, to the executive director of the United Nations Environment Programme, the UNEP. And in Brisbane, we have our old friend John Quiggan, Federation Fellow in Economic and Political Science at the University of Queensland. Welcome, one and all. Anne, to you first. Is Anne with us?
Yes, here I am.
Thanks, Anne. We're having so much technical problems, I'm not quite sure who's with me. Tell us the main reason why you believe that the consequences of the current financial crisis are going to get much worse. Come on, you know, be gloomy.
I hate to be gloomy, but I was looking at Australia's numbers today in advance of this call, and you know, when we talk about the credit crunch, we don't understand why this bubble burst. We tend to think that it burst as a result of some form of, you know, spontaneous combustion, but you've just got to look at Australia's interest payment numbers. And the share of Australia's income going towards paying interest to see why the bubble burst. It's because, you know, borrowing costs in Australia for households, for corporates, for individuals, for the government even, are extremely high. And at some point, they just are not payable anymore. And the peaks of rises in interest rates in Australia are really quite rocky mountain peaks, actually. So we haven't quite got there to be really gloomy, because what's happened is we've had a bursting of the subprime bubble, and we've had a bursting of, if you like, the mortgage bubble, including, I believe, in Australia. But there is still another bubble to be burst, and that's corporate bubbles, the corporate debt bubble, and the peak in interest payments in borrowing costs for corporates are now really quite high. So,
and I'm now wishing I'd fallen off my ladder last night, rather. It might have been the best thing to do. Now, the bailouts haven't stemmed the downward spiral of the stock market, have they? They don't seem to have restored much trust in the system yet. Do you think any or all of them are likely to do so?
No, because what the bailouts are doing, they're dealing with one half of the equation. They're dealing with the creditors. They're dealing with the bankers. They're dealing with the finance system, which is responsible for this mess in the first place. And in Australia, the finance sector has taken a big chunk of Australia's income over the last few months, and now it's taking a big chunk, I assume, of Australian taxpayers' funds, and globally that is happening. But you've got to, governments have to address both sides of the equation. We've got to look at the debtors. We've got to bail them out. We've got to, in a sense, put a floor under the collapse in house prices and a floor under the collapse in you know, corporate investment, if we're going to put a floor under this the whole crisis. And I'm afraid our central bank governors and our finance ministers haven't seen that yet, haven't understood that yet.
Let's ask John Quiggan whether he's as gloomy as Ann Pettifer. What do you think, John?
Well, I think there's certainly more trouble to come. Ann's mentioned corporate problems. There's also a bunch of consumer debt problems, credit card debt in the US that has really yet to come home to roost, and almost certainly we'll see increasing defaults there. I mean, in fact, we're already seeing them, commercial real estate and so forth. So far, of course, in Australia, we haven't really had had big effects, despite
Let's agree. The world is in a terrible state of chassis, as the great Irish playwright Sean O'Casey used to say. You've written in the Fin Review quite often, John, that this is time for an active climate change policy. This is what a foolish attitude. Don't you realise we can't possibly afford it?
Well, I think on the contrary, we're going to see almost certainly a significant decline in private investment, certainly over the duration of the immediate crisis, but quite possibly going ahead some years in the future. So in that sense, the opportunity to invest resources in climate change is actually increased by the crisis rather than being diminished.
The other night I made the probably fatuous observation that at least a recession, a global recession, might give us breathing space in terms of great belching carbon emissions. What thinkest thou?
Well, unfortunately, because carbon emissions are roughly proportional to the economy in those kind of terms, if you cut the economy by 5%, for example, which is a pretty hefty recession, you only get a 5% reduction in emissions. So really, we need to look at things that enable us to use carbon more smartly, use a lot less of it to produce the same standard of living, if we're going to get the kind of 50 or 60 or 80 or 90% reductions that people have been talking about, because I don't think people are going to want a 90% reduction in economic activity.
Now, John, Berlusconi is not alone in saying this is a time to put any talk of carbon trading aside until the financial crisis is over. Your response?
Well, I mean, I suppose that's the kind of thing you'd expect from Berlusconi, unfortunately. It really isn't a sensible response. It's more a case, I think, of the kind of argy-bargy that inevitably goes on in the European Union policies, indeed in any federal system. We know that we're already seeing, of course, people putting their bid in that that they should be exempted from bearing any pain. But I think you'd hear that kind of excuse all the time. I mean, I think we're going to certainly have to do things somewhat differently in the light of a financial crisis than we were expecting. We certainly, I think, expected the financial markets to play a big role in developing a carbon trading market, and the kind of derivatives that might have gone with that, and we'll probably have to go for something simpler and more old-fashioned.
Before we cross to Nick Nuttall in Nairobi, back to you, Anne. I want to ask you a bit about the aforementioned Green New Deal that's been proposed by the New Economics Foundation. Did it come about as a response to the financial crisis, or was it already sitting on your desk? Anne Pettifor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
All right, sorry about that. We've been aware for some time now that, the New Economics Foundation is a green economics foundation, actually. And so we've been aware of the climate change threat for years. But what is also looming forward now and on the front page of our Financial Times is the peak oil threat. And so we feel there's a treble threat facing us, a triple crunch of a financial crunch, a credit crunch, plus an oil crunch, plus the climate change crunch. And we've got to address all three. And I have to say, you know, Berlusconi is deeply depressing.
He's always been deeply depressing.
He is indeed. But Barack Obama only last week once again repeated his pledge to invest $15 billion a year in renewable sources of energy and to create 5 million more what he calls green jobs. We say there's a need to mobilize a carbon army of green collar workers to invest in insulating homes, for example, to invest in turning every building into a power station. At the moment, we lose an enormous amount of energy by transmitting power across the whole of the country and losing en route quite a lot of it. So we want to turn every building into a power station, and then we want to build renewable energy. Now, that will take labour and it will take money, but the point about public spending that we must not forget is the wonderful old thing called the Keynesian concept of the multiplier effect, that, you know, it pays for itself in due course. You know, people get jobs, they pay taxes, the money goes back into the government's coffers. Or they go into the shops and they buy things and the money goes into the private sector's coffers. So, you know, this is perfectly affordable and perfectly sensible to do in a time of recession.
This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable in ever-increasing numbers on your pod. And we're discussing the Green New Deal with Ann Pettifer, with John Quiggin, and now with Nick Nuttall from the United Nations Environment Programme. Nick, there's I'm pretty impressed so far with the United Nations Green Economy Initiative. Can you tell the listener about it?
Yes, well, I mean, in a sense, it echoes what some of your other guests are saying. I mean, the fact is that we need to accept the fact that we are facing multiple crises, but also multiple opportunities. I mean, the other one to throw into the pot is the nature crisis, or the nature crunch. I mean, it's pretty clear that climate change has already been described as a market failure, but we've got other market failures looming, from whether it be fish stocks or whether it be destruction of forests. In fact, according to some estimates, I mean, the annual cost of forest loss is between $2 trillion and $5 trillion a year, which is more than, you know, what we're doing to deal with the banking crisis and the credit crunch.
Nick, I take it the fact that you've launched your initiative a couple of months earlier than was planned is so that you can jump the queue with G20.
Well, absolutely. There are these major meetings coming up. We have fast-forwarded what we were planning because clearly we need to influence some of the decisions that are going to be taken in terms of where money is going to go. I mean, like Anne said, you know, we need to make this money work harder. I mean, if we are going to invest in infrastructure developments or stimulus packages, then why not make them zero emission? And this is kind of the philosophy behind it. And at the same time, I mean, there's 1.3 billion people in the world right now who are unemployed or underemployed, and there'll be 500 million people coming onto the market, the job market, in the next 10 years. So that's quite a lot of people we've got to find jobs for. Now, the question is, are they going to be part of the old 20th century economy? In other words, do we get them to work building more motor cars and more iPods? How many motor cars do you need? You know, do we all need 20 iPods? Well, no, there may be smarter ways of actually shaping the economy that delivers multiple benefits and also delivers new enterprises and new jobs, not least in conservation. I mean, for example, under the climate agreement, the governments are looking very closely at, you know, paying countries not to chop their trees down. Well, this could not only deliver important benefits for climate, but also benefits for biodiversity, soils, water storage, and also jobs in terms of managing forests in a pro-climate friendly way.
Now, Nick, you've persuaded me in 5 minutes. Who is going to tell G20 this? Who will take the message to G20? Will it be Gordon Brown?
Well, you know, there are a lot of leaders out there who have already got the message. I mean, this Green Economy Initiative is not coming from ground zero. You already see around the world governments making deliberate policy decisions in favor of what we call, you know, a green economy. I mean, if you go to Mexico, President Calderon is paying 1.5 million rural people to actually manage the forests and the water systems there because they know that's a good investment, particularly in a climate or carbon-constrained world as we're heading. You'll need your forests and your watersheds even more than you need them today.
Okay, I accept that there has been a change, a blatant change of the zeitgeist, but who will be the driver at G20? What about Ban Ki-moon? Is he on the right page?
Ban Ki-moon is right behind this initiative. Indeed, he is fully supporting it. I mean, what about President Lee of Korea? I mean, Achim Stein, the head of UNEP, was in Korea yesterday. President Lee has a green growth policy now, including investments in renewables, changing the structure of their car industry to go for hybrids or plug-in hybrids. If you look at, Gordon Brown has been making some positive statements about that. Nicolas Sarkozy in France. There are many, many leaders there. The question is, the green economy is out there, but it's like a library in which, you know, it's in different shelves, and you need to bring it all together, which is, in a sense, what our Green Economy Initiative is about. But there are enough leaders out there getting the message that we need to manage the world's economies. I mean, globalization has been operating on this kind of short-term, let the markets dictate, but the markets are not God-given. You know, they're shaped by human beings. So what do we want out of the 21st century economy? And that's the question.
Anne Pettifor, I like it when you point out that money is man-made, interest rates are a social construct, that we've got to look beyond orthodox monetary policy for what one might describe as a 21st century economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I come back on your point on leadership? Because I don't agree. I don't think there is leadership out there. I think our leaders are timid and afraid, and you know, they're not up to the task. And therefore, it takes, in my view, social movements. The leaders don't fall out of the blue sky. They don't come out of context. Barack Obama is the result of a movement inside the Democrat Party called MoveOn.org, where they just systematically and in a very focused way went, first of all, to try and find leaders who would get the United States out of Iraq, and then more or less replaced the representatives in the Congress. And then they went and looked for a leader to stand as president. And, you know,
oh, you're a skeptical woman.
I am indeed, and they found one. And the fact is that he's done extraordinarily well. But it requires people to get off their butts, if you like, and to go out there and organize. And I think we've got to stop saying that we think there are leaders out there that will do it, and we've got to get out and demand that they do it and make our voices heard. Because,
well, Anne, let me ask you this in parenthesis.
They're all over us, as they've done now.
In parenthesis, I agree with you, and I've been raising the issue on the program for some years, wondering whether, in fact, democratic governments are suitably equipped, structurally appropriate to this scale of crisis. Do you think that they can lift their game?
I think they can. The trouble is democratic governments at the moment have been corrupted by the finance sector. I mean, we have a scandal here in Britain at the moment where our politicians of both parties have been caught on yachts with Russian oligarchs doing fancy deals, you know. They should not be there. They should be at home, accountable to their people, and they've forgotten what it's like to be accountable to their people. And we've allowed the political system, if you like, to be displaced. We've allowed others to take over where democratic voices should be heard. And I think we've got to get political again, all of us. We've all of us very cynical and disillusioned with the system, and we've given it away, if you like, to those oligarchs. We've got to take it back again and demand that it speaks for us.
John Quiggin, I often tell the listener about the coal mines that I drive through on the way back home. And, of course, they're not labour-intensive. Very few people actually work in the damn things. The toys they drive are immense. In contrast, you make the point, and it's terribly important, that the new renewable energies are more labour-intensive than the fossil fuel industries.
That's right, and I think that's one of the reasons why the idea that we should forget about doing anything in a recession is a mistake. I mean, I think it's clear that we need to take account of the fact that although there aren't nearly as many people per dollar of output who work in those industries as in other areas, there are people who work there, and if those industries contract, they're likely to lose their jobs. We have to be active about trying to find new jobs and new industries, but we also have to bear in mind all the time that there are going to be more gainers than winners in terms of employment out of this kind of process. I think we're reaching with climate change the kind of point that Australia reached only relatively recently, say, with the problems of water and Murray-Darling, where we're going beyond the things that everybody's happy to give the nods to, the compact fluorescent light bulbs and those kind of things. Two things which will undoubtedly hurt, even though there's going to be a net benefit.
John, there's already a sort of a widespread feeling that we've all got to behave ourselves, and the truly conservative virtues of thrift and caution are already coming to the fore, to the great distress of our retailers. Might not these virtues be extendable to the conservation movement?
Well, absolutely. I mean, they're of course, conservative virtues, and the words conservation and conservatism come from the same source, and indeed we see much more true conservatism in the environmental movement, trying to conserve what we've inherited from the past, than we do among the political movements that are commonly called conservative.
Yeah. Nick, the G20 summit won't be held in isolation. There'll be plenty going on in the areas of jobs in the green economy.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've got a whole series of things coming up, but I mean, the one of the most crucial dates is, you know, is December 2009 in Copenhagen, Denmark, when governments really have to get down and agree on a deep and decisive emission reduction and adaptation package on climate change. That's where a lot of the things are heading. And indeed, this greening of the economy that we're seeing around the world in part is as a result of the UN Climate Change Convention and the market mechanisms that were brought in related to that, the Kyoto Protocol. But if things unravel in Copenhagen, then we may see a very big setback to this idea of reshaping and re-guiding our global economies onto something better.
Your organisation points out that there are at least 10 million people in China working in recycling. There are 1 million farmers in Africa growing organic food, if only because they can't afford to buy insecticide, and their yields are increasing. In Mexico, 1.5 million rural people are now paid to look after forests and rivers, etc.
Yes, absolutely. So these are some of the examples that we're citing. I mean, and the fact is that investments in renewable energy grew 60% between 2006 and 2007, in part because of the climate change agreement. So, I mean, what we're actually advocating in this initiative is I mean, we do need leaders in this world. I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt, who you mentioned earlier, was a leader who took a stand in the Great Depression and, in a sense, set the stage for the greatest growth the world's ever seen. Well, we've got new challenges in the 21st century, and we do need leaders. I totally agree that we need the public to, in a sense, demand that their leaders make these changes. But in a sense, you're seeing a lot of corporations around the world and companies who also want some kind of global deal where they know, in fact, you know, the playing field in which they're in. We were approached just recently by somebody in the biofuels industry, you know, desperate that there was some kind of norms and standards set on biofuels so they knew where they could operate without, you know, killing their markets by angry consumers. So there's a lot of interest out there in some kind of change in the way this world's managed, and also multilateral change as well through the UN.
And I'm persuaded that many of our leaders are really followers who don't move until they've seen the polls, or in fact, a putty in the hands of pressure groups. And we were talking last night on the program about the incredible mosaic of influences that are creating the Obama phenomenon. And this is a portrait of what you're talking about. It's lots and lots and lots of little voices who are now drowning out the big voices of the past.
Exactly. And, you know, what we have as a tool now is something we've not had before, which is the web. We are now able to communicate with each other without having to go through the various sensors that have operated in respected media such as your own, if I may say so. People are now able to talk to each other directly and straightly without intermediaries. And this has been an enormous contribution to Obama's success, because young people in particular have taken to the web, have been able to rebut arguments, have been able to put arguments, have been able to get views across, share those views, without having them moderated by very reluctant, if you like, editors on newspapers and magazines. So that is transforming the political debate. And I think Aussies and the Brits and all of us have to join in this. But understand that you can't just do it on the web. You also need to have town hall meetings.
Absolutely.
You know? Look, on the ground with people where they are in their communities.
And we've got to wrap it, but I thank you for cheering me up. I will not jump off the ladder after all. Anne Pettifer, Executive Director of Advocacy International, Senior Associate at NEF, the New Economics Foundation. She's the author of The Coming First World Debt Crisis, a rather prescient title. John Quiggin, Federation Fellow in Economics and Political Science at the University of Queensland, and Nick Nuttall, spokesperson to the Executive Director of the United Nations Environment Programme, who was speaking to us from Nairobi. LNL, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable on your pod. And this is the first programme I've done by Braille.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.